Hello, I'm Jason, and this is episode 8 of my podcast here at pointsandfocus.com. Last week, I said that I was going to be talking about the 5D Mark IV, and I'm going to be talking about the 5D Mark IV today. Before I jump into that, though, I do want to make a single correction on something I said last week, which was that the EOS M3 cannot have the autofocus decoupled from the shutter release. It can. I ended up coming to that kind of mistaken conclusion because I wasn't really looking for the function the way the function was described. And hey, I only had the camera for 2 days when I did that podcast, so, you know, it was very much a first thoughts kind of thing. In fact, to decouple the focus, autofocus from the shutter release and use the camera basically in two button or rear button focusing, it's the first setting in the camera control menu. You change it from the first option to the second option, and then the camera uses the auto exposure lock button for autofocus and the shutter release for metering, and then there's no auto exposure lock. Secondly, I want to apologize. This is going to be a long podcast. I know it. I sat down to write up the show notes before I recorded this because I wanted to make sure I had it clear the kinds of things or the things that I wanted to touch on, and what I expected to be like a couple hundred words turned into like 4,200 words. And yeah, so if this is, too long, and, you know, I don't know how long it's going to be. Obviously, it'll be displayed you either in your podcasting app or when you go to look at it on the site. But if this is too long, I will not be offended if you just don't want to listen to me talk and ramble for however long this is going to take. Unfortunately, the reality of modern cameras is that they're extraordinarily complicated, especially now that they've added video and all these other new functions. And that just leaves a lot of points to talk about. When I did my review for the 5D Mark III, I ended up writing 25,000 words. And when I was done with that, I was tired of writing, and I still felt that there was a number of things that I really needed to cover in the camera or on the camera. This isn't a review. I don't have a 5D Mark III yet. I have pre-ordered one, but I'm not sure, you know, when exactly I'm going to get it. Even when I get the 5D, I won't have a review for quite some time because I don't like to rush to say, here's X, and not have a real good feeling of the camera. Also, because I tend to avoid super quantitative type, you know, it's got 7 stops of dynamic range kind of things in my reviews. And focus more on how the camera actually works and behaves in practice and in real use. It takes a longer time to test and evaluate and get a feel for the camera. So, you know, I'm hoping to have my camera before the end of September. You know, with the way this ends up going, I have no idea if that's going to happen, but I probably will be, much like I expect to be talking about the M3 in the next month or two, probably two. I'll probably be talking about the 5D Mark IV repeatedly in the next couple of months. Also, I've noticed several times in just thinking about and going about sort of the start of this podcast that for some reason I keep saying or keep thinking in my head that I said Mark III when I mean Mark IV. I will try to make it a point to not screw that up while I'm talking. So let's dive right into my thoughts on the 5D Mark IV. I try not to read it. I try not to get too involved in reading stuff on the internet posted by other people about cameras because, truthfully, there's a lot of people that just sort of seem to assume they know everything about engineering and everything about photography, and this should be the way it is, and da 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 da. And then they get really angry that some company didn't do what they wanted or think what they think should have been done. And then the vitriol starts flying and people blah, blah, blah. I mean, a perfect example of this is Matt Granger. He used to be that Nikon guy. Then he changed his branding to that camera guy. He published a YouTube video that basically said that he thought the 5D Mark IV was going to be the most significant camera announced this year. And then the flames started. And then he posted a clarification on the things that he meant, why he felt that way. And the insults started even further. And again and again and again. And let me just be upfront about this. I don't think the 5D is going to be the most significant, or is the most significant camera announced in 2016. I don't think there's a significant camera announced, period, anymore. I think the last significant camera that was announced was probably the first mirrorless camera from Olympus in 4/3 format, as that sort of changed things dramatically. Maybe you could argue that the 5D Mark II was a significant camera when it was released, because it kicked off this whole video still convergent revolution thing. In some respects, the 5D Mark IV isn't even the first camera in Canon's line of cameras to get on-chip audio analog digital converters, on-chip ADCs. And so you can't even argue that it's the most significant Canon innovation in, you know, a long time or something like that. The 1D Mark II and the 80D beat the 5D to having on-chip ADCs. And even then, you could certainly argue that, you know, other cameras are certainly more significant or whatnot. But that said, the 5D Mark IV is definitely the most significant camera for me this year, in no small part or entirely because it's the next camera that I'm upgrading to from Canon's product line. And so while it might not be significant to everyone, it is a pretty significant step forward in technology for a Canon shooter, and it's a pretty significant step forward in technology for me personally. So, you know, like I said, that's why I think it's interesting. That said, you know, I've done these kinds of, well, I've done them in text form in the past. I've never done them as a podcast, but I've done these kinds of, you know, Canon or Nikon announces a camera and I go write up a thing about what I think they did right and what I think they did wrong. And that's kind of my intention here. It's certainly possible that, you know, once I get the camera and start to play with it, I have some new thoughts on some of these things. But, you know, I wanted to talk about that. So the first place I'm going to start is with video. And truthfully, video is not a huge selling point to me. I'm still a photographer. I appreciate that there's a lot of people that, you know, want to shoot video on their cameras or that they use DSLRs for video because it's cheap. But from my perspective, if Canon or Nikon or any of the manufacturers can deliver good quality video on the camera, that's a plus. But the primary focus of an SLR is still photography. I even argued back when the whole convergence thing movement started that from just a usability and ergonomics perspective, SLRs are the wrong camera if you're a video shooter. I find it absolutely hilarious, you know, in reading some of the comments that Matt Granger got, that the vitriol from people who have sort of decided that SLRs are video cameras and this is their primary function, and that when the video implementation isn't up to the snuff of these people, that they're pissed off at Canon for giving them less than superb performance or whatever. And, you know, to me, it's like, I don't get it, because I've tried shooting video with my 5D Mark III, and you buy a $3,500 camera, and then you need almost $3,500 of associated miscellaneous rails and mounts and mat boxes and follow focuses and whatnot to do any good or to do good work with it. It's not just okay, I've got this camera and, you know, I can go and I can shoot video and it's going to be awesome. And moreover, you know, while you're complaining as a video guy about, you know, the performance of the video or the codec Canon chose or something like that, why don't you complain about all the other annoying, you know, still photography features that are built into the camera, like, you know, having a mirror box and a mirror and that has to rotate out of the way and an optical viewfinder? What do you need that crap for? And a non-articulating display and so on and so forth, you know, that just the whole slew of things that cause the phase detect autofocus system, the separate metering sensor, you know, all the things that still photographers are still using and need or use in their work. And, you know, it's not a video function. And like I said, this is not a video camera. It's a testament to the power and flexibility of digital sensors. And, you know, I mean, in some ways it's inevitable that the sensor technology supports this kind of unification. But, you know, if you're looking for a 4K raw 240 frame per second HFR video camera, the 5D Mark IV is not the camera for you. You want to look at something else, like a C300 Mark II or a Blackmagic Cinema Camera or an RE, you know, Alexa or Alara or whatever their, you know, thing, premium thing is, or a Sony F9 or F6 or whatever their dedicated video camera setup is. And, you know, I applaud Sony. Sony has pretty solid video capabilities in their mirrorless alpha cameras, and that's good for them. And, you know, congratulations or whatever. And to the people that are bitching about Canon not doing that in the 5D, why don't you go get a Sony Alpha? But anyway, so that's sort of, I guess, my rant on the sort of commentary on video. So let's talk a little bit about video. The 5D Mark IV introduces DCI 4K resolution to Canon's mid-tier camera lineup. The 1DC had it, the 1DX Mark II had it, and now the 5D Mark IV has DCI 4K. I'm given the choice of resolutions. Well, to start with, I find it rather obnoxious that Quad HD, which is like 3860 by 2140 or something like that, it's not even 4,000 pixels wide, and Quad HD gets called 4K, and it's like, well, yeah, but you're like 150 or something like that pixels short of, or 200 pixels short of having an actual 4,000 pixel wide image. Most of the other companies that have gone and done the whole video thing in their SLRs or mirrorless cameras have gone with Quad HD. It certainly is what Nikon's done. I'm pretty sure it's what Sony did too. I'm of two minds of this. For starters, DCI 4K is higher resolution. So if you need Quad HD output, you can downsample or crop in post-production and have a Quad HD image. You have the information there. You have to do something to get to it, but you have the information there already. On the other hand, if you want to go from Quad HD to DCI 4K, you have to upsample because you're 200 lines short or 200 rows short, and you have to then, you know, deal with that. And so there is some degradation in image quality going from Quad HD to 4K, but not from 4K to Quad HD. The sort of question ends up being, I guess, is what's your target? Like, you know, are you targeting television, broadcast television, or are you targeting cinema? Because DCI 4K is the cinema resolution, and Quad HD is the television resolution. And I can kind of understand why Canon keeps going with DCI 4K over Quad HD, because their legacy, if you will, is cinematography, the actual movie content production, not necessarily, well, I shouldn't say legacy, but the cinema EOS system, that whole sort of slant is predicated around the idea of cinema and not just TV. And like I said, because you can't go up, you can only go down, it does limit, you know, if you're producing a 4K camera that's only Quad HD, that limits it from being used as a, you know, like B-roll kind of camera in an environment that requires DCI 4K. The other major change in the video system is now we have 120 frame per second HFR video in 720p. This is a feature I'm rather happy to see. I've been somewhat depressed by the fact that my iPhone SE can do 120 and 240 frame per second HFR video, and my SLRs can't. The point where I'm disappointed is that it's 720p and not 1080p. Now, you know, I think it's entirely fair to call Canon out on that, insofar as, you know, it would have been nice to have that as 1080p at 120 frames per second. Personally, I'm not terribly upset by it because my use of HFR is largely in sort of scientific engineering information gathering and not in production of video, like, you know, cinematography type production of video. So having it makes it useful for me as opposed to having it at 1080p. So the rundown is you can shoot 720p at up to 120 frames per second in NTSC mode and 100 frames per second in PAL mode. You can shoot 1080p at up to 60 frames per second in NTSC mode and 50 frames per second in PAL mode. And you can shoot 4K at up to 30 frames per second in NTSC mode or 25 frames per second in PAL mode. Like I said, video is not sort of the strongest thing that I'm interested in the camera. So where the debate, I should touch on where the debate comes from is the 720p and 1080p video is compressed using the H.264 codec. That's what the 5D Mark III uses. That's what your phone uses. That's kind of the standard sort of for the industry high efficiency compression algorithm. The 4K video is compressed using Motion JPEG, which is an old, I kind of don't know if I want to call it antiquated, but you could say that depending on your perspective, compression algorithm that basically in Motion JPEG, there is no temporal compression. So you don't have, in H.264, you have iframes, which are basically whole pictures. And then you have P frames and B frames that are frames that reference the change over time from the last iframe in the picture. And so those frames can become really small because if there isn't any change over time, the data that has to be stored is not significant. If with an all-I format, like which Motion JPEG is essentially an all-I format, which, you know, that was an option in the 5D Mark III using H.264, but Motion JPEG is an all-I format that fundamentally is full resolution of whatever the frame is. So in 4K, it's an 8.8 megapixel JPEG, and it's just basically a sequence of 8.8 megapixel JPEGs stored in a movie container. I'd have to defer to people who are more familiar with editing it. There are some trade-offs in editing it because it's not H.264, and therefore, like, it won't be hardware accelerated on devices that can accelerate H.264 and so on and so forth. Quality-wise, because this is one of the places where I'm not, like, I understand sort of the argument, but the theory behind the argument or the vitriol is not really accurate. Quality-wise, Motion JPEG can be really good or it can be really poor. It depends on what the encoder is set to for the quality standard and how big of a file and how much bitrate you're willing to give to it. The question in my mind is, what's that going to be for the 5D Mark IV? I've seen in the manual, they talk about what the file size per minute of video is, but I don't have a good feel for how H.264 all-I versus Motion JPEG compression shakes out quality-wise versus size-wise, or, you know, at similar bit rates or so forth. So I can see where the angst is coming from in that in some respects, but at the same time, I go back to my point, which is that this is a still camera that, you know, 4K, it's nice to have, but, you know, once you start in on the, like, you, I want all these video features, you kind of, I think Canon's sort of thought process in response to this is if you want 4K raw video, which I've seen people posting about, like, this camera's crap because it doesn't have 4K raw video, and I've seen a couple assertions that you can't output 4K over the HDMI. I'm not not entirely sure about the validity of that. I'm going to take them at face value for the moment until I see something that says either way. But for, you know, if you want 4K raw video, again, you know, and I'm pretty sure this is going to be Canon's feeling on that too, buy a C300 Mark II or, you know, a, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you're demanding top tier cinematographic capabilities in a $3,500 still camera. So, like I said, video isn't my key or isn't the biggest thing that I'm interested in with this camera. It is the one thing that I've seen that's sort of the most contentious. And in some respects, I think it's one of the things that probably ends up being things people want or people look at spec wise, which is why I kind of wanted to touch on it first. Things that really interest me, autofocus, specifically the phase detect autofocus. The 1DX brought all points to F8, our capabilities of using all the autofocus points at F8, and the 5D Mark IV retains that and brings that down to the 5D line. And for me, this is huge. This is, like I said, I don't care about video. Video people can go argue about video capabilities somewhere else and, you know, till their heart's content. I'm a still guy. And you could argue, well, if you're such a still guy, why are you worried about F8 lenses or whatever? Well, primarily because when it comes down to telephoto, the telephoto end of things, your options, or my options at least, are really fast primes, so like 300 2/8, 400 2/8, 500 f/4s, 600 f/4s, that kind of thing, that have two, I mean, don't get me wrong, those are phenomenally good lenses, but they have two serious, in my opinion, downsides. One, they're ridiculously expensive. A 300 2/8 L Mark II with image stabilization is $6,000. A 500 f/4 L IS-2 is $9,000. I mean, that's, you know, basically twice the cost of the camera that we're sitting here talking about, and or more. And, you know, it just goes up 600s and 800s, you know, and, you know, even something like the 200 to 400 is north of $10,000. The cost for me ends up being prohibitive, that when push comes to shove, I can scrape together $3,000 or $4,000 for a camera, or $3,000 or $4,000 for a lens, but not 12. The second factor is they're just huge. They're big, heavy, you know, I mean, it's a side effect of being a long, fast lens, but they're big and heavy. And given the option of carrying around a, you know, 8 to 10 pound lens all day, day in and day out in various, you know, places, especially like in the field doing wildlife or on a pitching boat in a, you know, doing whale watching or something like that. Not something I'm tremendously interested in doing. I mean, again, phenomenal image quality, phenomenal lenses, but I'd rather have something that's lighter. And I have something that's lighter. I have a 100 to 400 Mark L or 100 to 400 L Mark II. And for me, it's a phenomenally good lens, but once you stick a teleconverter on it, you're at F8, and with the my 1D Mark III and my 5D Mark III, that was basically center autofocus point only. Now, for static subjects, you know, bird on a perch or a lion sitting there doing nothing or a leopard sitting in a tree or, you know, a bear laying in the grass, that limitation isn't that big of a deal. You can relatively easily, you know, focus and recompose and take pictures with a single autofocus point and not be completely doomed. On the other hand, once the subject starts moving, you run into it. It poses a sort of significant problem. The problem ends up being that you either have to have really poor compositions, in that, like, if you're focusing on the eyes have to be in the center of the frame, and therefore you're kind of cutting off part of the animal. You have very little area to track something, so if a bird in flight or something like that, you only have a very small part of the autofocus system to keep on the bird while it's flying and moving, and you're trying to pan with it with the camera. And the combination of the forced composition and the limited area to track over really limits the ability to use that kind of lens in that kind of situation. And that's the kind of thing I like to shoot. And, you know, of course, you know, the one answer would be to get a new lens, a much more expensive lens, one that doesn't have that limitation. But then, you know, it's back to, you know, everything in photography is trade-offs. And this is the trade-off between money and weight and capabilities and performance. And for me, that trade-off is towards, you know, not spending the money and not carrying the weight. So where the autofocus at f8 on all of the autofocus points comes in is that pretty much breathes a huge slew of life into a huge range of a lot of lenses. And, you know, honestly, it goes beyond just the 100 to 400 that I have. You know, if you have a 500 f4 and you put a 2x teleconverter on it, you know, that would, in the past, give you a 1,000mm f8, and you'd only have one autofocus point. Now you have all of your autofocus points, or most of your autofocus points. A 600 f4 with a 2x teleconverter gives you a 1,200 f8, and you still have all or most of your autofocus points. And, you know, it's not just, I won't say the cheap guy, like me or whatever, it's even the really high-end photographers that the increase in autofocus capabilities makes available shots that otherwise would have been difficult or impossible to get. And see, to me, and I've wrote about this previously, you know, when Nikon announced the D4 or the D5 and the D500, they also, their announcement was that the camera came with this huge 153, I think it was, point autofocus system. And of course, when you stopped and you looked at it, the Nikon autofocus system, there were 55 points you could select, a whole slew of points that were, you know, assist points, and the F8 capabilities were actually worse than the D4s. And to me, while that would help, or while that helps a lot of photographers potentially shooting with fast lenses on the you know, shorter end, it's not the kind of thing that makes such a wide sweeping change or benefit is having what Canon did and went with, you know, it's the same number of points. The area, autofocus area is spread out a little bit more, but they're now all capable of hitting or running at F8. And the center 21 are capable of cross type at F8 with the right lens and teleconverter combination. So, I mean, it's not a shabby system at all. That it's a, you know, really beneficial thing for, like I said, especially like wildlife photographers or anybody who needs to use really long lenses or wants to work with light lenses. They don't, you know, they need reach, but they don't want to carry around an extra 10 or so pounds. So that's a big point, selling point in the 5D Mark IV for me. The next big selling point in the 5D Mark IV is built-in GPS. And, well, I'm going to say and Wi-Fi, but I'll save Wi-Fi and come back to that. Since going to Alaska, I've written it somewhat extensively about the issues that I have with not knowing where I took pictures, because I can't identify the spot or the stretch of ocean or the mountain ranges I'm not familiar enough with to identify, you know, where I was here. And I really, in retrospect, would have liked to have had GPS data for, you know, where I was and when I was there. And I started looking into this for my upcoming trip to the parks of the Southwest, you know, Grand Canyon, Zion, that kind of stuff. And I kind of was close to settling on running GPS for Cam, which is a track logging app on my old iPhone, and just using that basically as a standalone GPS unit, and then struggling through the process of sticking timestamps and getting the time squared away and making sure everything was in sync and syncing the coordinates in with Lightroom. And I mean, that was not the greatest solution, but it certainly was the cheapest solution. The best solution I could do on my 5D Mark III was to buy a Canon GPE 1 or GPE 2 or whatever it is, GPS receiver that slots into your hot shoe and provides the functionality of, you know, in-camera timestamp and date stamp and GPS geotagging. That, of course, that's a $250 add-on, and it requires a AA or AAA battery, and you have to remember to plug it in, and when it's hooked up, you can't use your hot shoe for a flash, and so on and so forth. And not really, you know, it's a better option than track logging on a standalone GPS, but it's not really an ideal solution to the whole GPS problem. The ideal solution is what the 5D Mark IV has. The GPS is built in the camera. You don't have to remember batteries. You don't have to remember to bring it with you. You just have to remember to turn it on, and it will record where you were when you took the picture and automatically insert that into the picture. And now I fully appreciate that there's probably a, you know, whole lot of people who just really don't care about geotagging, that they don't care about, you know, where they took pictures down to the meter or down to, you know, the local half mile. They knew they took this picture when they were on vacation in Italy, and that's good for them. And you know, I don't begrudge them for not really caring. And, you know, truthfully, this is not something that is, this is a personal OCD thing for me. It's not really a job necessity. I don't absolutely need to have accurate information about where I took a picture, but I really want that information just to satisfy my own personal need to have detailed information about things. So the built-in GPS is a major plus for me. I was actually impressed in reading through the manual. Canon will actually do track logging with the GPS, where even if you're not taking pictures every 5 minutes or, well, it's usually configurable, but like every couple of minutes or whatever, the camera can take a GPS reading and save the track log into a section of internal memory, and you can, you know, have track logs from this. So, you know, if you're hiking or something like that and you wanted a track log and you had the battery power to spare, so to speak, that you could have that log done in the camera's GPS and available when you downloaded your pictures. Of course, that is the downside of GPS. It burns battery. I have no idea how the impact is going to actually end up being in the Mark IV. It could be bad. It could be not so bad. It could be barely noticeable. I don't know. So that's something I'm going to be interested to see when, how, you know, how that plays out when I get the camera. The second point that I said there was Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi has always been a feature that I've been pretty much agnostic on. I've always seen where I really would like the feature and where it was a great thing in use or in operation, but I've always kind of gone like, yeah, but it's not really worth it, is it? That specifically, I do a lot of product photography for my website, Points in Focus, and I shoot that, well, the best way to shoot that would be tethered. I shoot that with a cheap SD card in the camera, and I take a couple pictures. I upload, you know, pull the card from the camera. I put it in a computer. I import the pictures into Lightroom. I review them, make whatever adjustments I need to the setup or the lighting or whatever, and go back and reshoot the pictures again. Where tethered, I would be able to hit the shutter release and have the picture show up on the monitor. The reason I don't shoot tethered is I am terrified of tripping over the cord and destroying things. The first camera I got I was very lucky, but I was at the time I was keeping it on top of my computer case, which sits on the floor. So it was only like 2 feet off the ground. And I reached over and I caught my arm or something on the camera strap. And the next thing I saw was my camera plummeting to the ground. Fortunately, it landed on the battery grip, which took the brunt of the impact, and the camera and lens were fine. And I just had to buy a new battery grip. But the thought of doing that with a $3,500 5D and the, $1,000, $2,000 L lens, that scares the crap out of me. And, if it's not the camera, then is it my laptop or is it the USB port that's getting ripped out and destroyed on the front of my computer where I have the camera plugged in, that kind of thing. I'm not an inherently clumsy person, but the having a USB cable tethering my camera to the computer and being on the floor, and especially if I'm working where I'm shooting handheld and I'm using my Black Rapid strap, so I have a place to just drop the camera to, the whole thought of, having a USB cable just, it's not something I've been good with, I like. And it's not like Wi-Fi tethering is new to Canon cameras, that they've done it since I could get a Wi-Fi adapter for my 40D. The problem is until basically now, Wi-Fi and cameras was like a $700 add-on, and that just was ridiculous. Like, I as nice as it would be, I couldn't see paying that kind of money to add wireless. Fortunately, it's basically, I won't say free, it's built into the cost of the 5D Mark IV, and I'm really looking forward to the ability to shoot tethered without a wire and have stuff come up on my machine as I'm doing it. So, like I said, agnostic feature, or I've never been a huge like, oh, we need this. This is absolutely critical. But I'm really kind of glad it's there. I think it's a positive thing. That brings me to, I want to talk a little bit about the image sensor. Probably should have talked about this early. Well, I hinted at it earlier. The 5D Mark IV is the third Canon camera to have on-chip ADCs, and more than dual pixel architecture or anything like that, that is the single biggest thing that Canon needed to implement to get out of the image quality rut that they were in, that poor dynamic range that was so constant sort of plague of Canon cameras at low ISOs. Obviously, since the 5D Mark IV is not available yet, it's hard to say what the performance is actually going to be. It will be a while until DxO Mark gets the camera and has optimized or has calculated numbers, but my guess, and this is purely a guess, is that the base ISO at ISO 100, the dynamic range is going to be somewhere between 13 and 13 and a half stops, or actually probably closer to 13.2 to 13 and a half stops. And my guess on this comes from a simple observation. The 1D Mark II gets 13 and a half stops based on DxO Mark scores, and the 80D gets 13.2 stops based on DxO Mark scores. Both of those are at ISO 100. And the 1DX has the sensor on the 1DX does 120 frames per second HFR video. It's a 20 megapixel sensor. It's so it's got bigger photo sites. The sensor on the 1D or the 80D is, I don't believe it does 120 frame per second HFR video, or at least the sensor might be able to do it, but I don't believe the camera supports it. But it's a 24 megapixel APS-C camera, and therefore it has pretty darn tiny photo sites. In fact, if you scale the sensor on the 80D up to full frame, you'd have, I think, a 65 megapixel sensor. So it's even higher, the pixel density is even higher than that of the 5DS. And both of those cameras, due to having on-chip analog-digital converters, are hitting north of 13 stops of dynamic range on DxO Mark's tests. And the 5D Mark III pixel size falls right between the two. Frame rate is lower than the 1D. HFR video is the same as the 1D, although the pixel read rate would be slightly higher. And all told, that to me indicates that it won't be as good as a 1D X Mark II, and it'll probably be better than an 80D in terms of dynamic range at the base ISO. Of course, you know, I could be wrong on this. I'm speculating based on the way I expect physics to behave and the sensors to behave and the fact that, you know, the getting the ADCs on chip is such a huge thing because it completely removes the whole noise and interference issue that becomes a problem with off-chip sensors. Specifically, you can put on chip an ADC for every row or every column, depending on the architecture you want to use. And that gives you, you know, thousands or hundreds of ADCs running in parallel. Whereas with off-chip ADCs, you know, you see Canon with like the 5DS was bragging about their 16 channels or something like that. Well, you know, that's 16 channels that need to read out 56 million points of, you know, 56 million pixels in, you know, a tiny fraction of a second. That those sensors have to run incredibly fast. And with analog digital converters, the faster they run and the faster the sample has to be cycled through, the lower the or the higher the noise you have in that system. And then, of course, because it's off chip, you had traces on the PCB carrying the analog signal from the sensor to the DIGIC chip, or it wasn't even in the DIGIC chip. It was on a separate camera or sensor controller chip. You had, you know, traces carrying, and that is susceptible to crosstalk. It's susceptible to interference from, you know, outside the camera or other circuits in the camera, and therefore more noise. And, you know, I've said for a while that as soon as Canon manages to go on-chip ADCs, there's going to be a boost in performance, and they're going to be back up in running with Nikon and Sony for dynamic range base ISOs. And, you know, we've seen that in the 1DX. It beats the D4 at base ISO and dynamic range, and we've seen that in the 80D. Not that it beats the top-end Nikon, but it's, you know, back up, it's up into 13 stops, not in the 11 and a half to 12 stop range that cameras were previously. And of course, this is going to be a stop and a half boost for the 5D, or for me over the 5D Mark III, because that camera only barely got 12 stops. So I'm pretty thrilled about that. I'm glad Canon finally got their act together. Of course, on that note, I've been saying for quite a while that, you know, I didn't really believe that Canon couldn't do on-chip ADCs. I thought that Canon's priorities were elsewhere, and specifically in getting the whole Cinema EOS thing up, because, you know, what people like to forget or tend to forget is that Canon, like any company, only has so much R&D money to go around, and spinning up an entirely new camera system line, whatever you want to call it, with lenses and so on and so forth, the engineering behind that isn't cheap, even if it uses a lot of similar technology to something that you already have in production. And, you know, it was right when Sony and Nikon made their biggest jumps in dynamic range right after the 5D Mark II came out that Canon started on this whole Cinema EOS thing, and Sony and Nikon were still doing, you know, most of their focus was on dynamic range and sensor performance. And, you know, I know a lot of people in comments and communities online were basically going like, Canon's a bunch of idiots, they don't know what they're doing, and totally ignoring the fact that they were spinning up they're dealing with a massive change in sort of priorities. Like, video was big. The Cinema EOS stuff was a, you know, important thing. And, you know, I won't rant about that too much or anymore, but, you know, there is that. So we now have on-chip ADCs in Canon cameras, and we're now seeing that Canon cameras are capable of 13.5-ish stops of dynamic range. I would also point out, because I'm sure someone would mention or, you know, go down this road, that with the current linear encoding of raw data in, so, you know, the, you know, I've, anybody who's done exposure to the right, you know, or whatever, has heard the whole thing about, you know, like the highest half of the file is dedicated to the first stop or holds data for the first stop, and then the next half below that holds data for the next stop. And so, like, if you had an 8-bit raw file, the brightest stop would be values 255 to 128, and then the next brightest stop would be values 127 to 64, and then the next brightest stop would be 64 or 63 to 32, and so on and so forth. But the end of that is basically you get as many stops of dynamic range in a raw file as you have bits. So, you know, we're using 14-bit raw files. The best, with the sort of naive linear encoding that's currently being used, is that you can have 14 stops of dynamic range. So barring a step up to 16-bit raw files in our DSLRs, you're never going to really see more than the whole 13.5 to 13.8 or so stops of actual dynamic range. Now, DxOMark muddies the waters a little bit because they have their print dynamic range where they downsample whatever the resolution of the image is to the 8x10 at 300 dpi, and they measure the dynamic range of that. And downsampling has an effect on lowering the noise floor, and therefore the dynamic range artificially becomes higher than what the format can inherently hold. And beyond that, and let me correct something. I did say this wrong. It's not the bit depth of the file that's limiting the dynamic range. It's the bit depth of the analog to digital converters. And then, of course, the file, if you don't use this linear naive encoding thing, you use something that actually models photon shot noise like Nikon's lossy raw compression does, you can store more than 14 stops in a 14-bit file or even a smaller file than that. But, you know, like I said, the promise is on-chip ADCs are going to mean, or should mean, that the 5D Mark III or Mark IV has improved dynamic range and improved noise performance and improved noise characteristics over its predecessor, the Mark III. Of course, you know, again, Canon could screw that up, in which case they are really a bunch of incompetent morons, but I don't really believe that's going to be the case, given that they didn't screw up the 1DX Mark II or the 80D. In other news on the sensor, the base ISO range has increased a third stop, which I found to be an interesting change. The 5D Mark III went from 100 to 25,600. The 5D Mark IV goes from 100 to 30,000. And Canon didn't mess with the extended stops, and I'll get back on that in a second. But I'm not entirely sure what the deal was with the base ISO range shifting the way the Canon shifted it. I suspect, given what I've kind of gleaned from talking to other photographers, that there is a number of photographers who work on a sort of mental thought process that as ISO's numbers increase, so does the image quality at lower ISOs. So if a camera can go is 50,000 instead of 25,000, then that camera will be better at ISO 100 than the camera that only could go to 25,000. And this is in part the next sort of thing, which is the extended ISOs on the 5D Mark IV are capped to 102,400. And you know what? I don't know if this, and I don't care if this is an artifact of Canon, you know, already having the camera too far along in production to do something about it, or Canon actually, I'm going to call it, having a brain on this. But I was very concerned when the Nikon D5 and D500 were released. Nikon put these ridiculously high ISOs, 1.6 million and 30 for the 5D or the D500 and 3.2 million for the D5. And a friend of mine got a D500 and we tested it. And, you know, I was absolutely astonished at how bad the images were at 1.6 million. And my concern was that all the other camera companies would see this and go, well, you know, we need to compete because numbers sell and we need to compete with big numbers. So we're going to have big numbers on our next camera, regardless of the consequences, and make big numbers, engineers. And I was, you know, like when I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, he was one of the people that pointed out in his way of thinking, if the, you know, highest ISO got higher, so, you know, with the D500, you know, it was all the way up to 1.6 million. If the highest ISO or when the highest ISO got higher, that was a strong indication that the lower image quality or the image quality at lower ISOs was really good too, or better, you know, than it was in past cameras too. And like in the case of the D5, at low ISOs, the image quality is basically the same as the D4. In fact, the camera within a half stop or so of noise and dynamic range, the D5 pretty much follows the D4 from over the entire range that the D4's ISOs are, and then everything above that, it just falls off a cliff. And it's clear to me that Nikon was looking for big numbers, not necessarily better or a fixed minimum quality range. And, you know, my concern, like I said, was that other camera companies would go, we need to have big numbers to compete, and they would start doing the big numbers and, you know, no concern about how that, you know, what quality was available. And I'm really glad to see, and like I said, I don't know if this is because the camera was too far into production or if this was just because somebody in Canon said, look, this is kind of ridiculous. But I'm really glad to see that with the 5D Mark IV, Canon isn't like putting, you know, ISO 1 million or ISO 1.6 million or something like that, and damn the consequences, the images will be crap, because honestly, I don't see anybody, you know, Sony, Nikon, Canon, doesn't matter. I don't really see anybody managing to have really good images at that high of an ISO. I mean, the only kind of exception to this is Canon's multifunction camera that goes to ISO 4 million, or the equivalent of ISO 4 million. And the only reason that that camera can do that is it's a 2.3 megapixel 1080p sensor that's a full frame 24 by 36 millimeter or 36 millimeter wide by whatever the vertical aspect or vertical size would be. It has ridiculously big pixels, and ridiculously big pixels collects a ton of light, and that enables the you know, more signal in to be amplified to get to much higher ISOs. A camera like the 5D Mark IV doesn't have ridiculously big pixels. It's not going to collect that kind of light on a per pixel basis, and that kind of high, really high ISO is just going to have absolutely abysmal image quality. So, like I said, I'm glad to see that Canon didn't take the bait, if you will, and go into this whole ridiculously high ISO competition. The final thing I want to touch on, I guess, basically in sensor is, well, the sensor kind of itself and resolution and ISO is the resolution. We're up to 30 megapixels, and I'm feeling comfortable that this is a reasonable upgrade. Every time, my first three cameras were all 10 megapixel cameras, a Digital Rebel XTi, a 40D, and a 1D Mark III. The build quality changed, the size of the sensor changed at the end, but the cameras all basically changed. It was a big jump for me going from the 10 or the 1D Mark III at 10 megapixels to the 5D Mark II or Mark III at 22.3 megapixels. And one of the biggest things, I mean, I had teething issues with dealing with the fact that I needed to have better, you know, better stance, better technique, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A little bit in lenses, but not so much because I was already shooting basically all L lenses and all pretty good L lenses. But the biggest thing for me with that jump was watching the capacity of my cards have. and watching how quickly I filled up storage on my, you know, computer when I went out shooting, and an 800-picture day went from being like a 16-card thing to a 32-gig-card thing. And, you know, a couple of those, and you're already throwing 100 gig in, and, you know, it doesn't take long for, you know, you need to have a couple terabytes, and then backing up a couple of terabytes, and, you know, it spirals. And so every time I see resolution jumps now, I won't say I get antsy, but I weigh how much the resolution jump versus the storage is going to be, or at least I think about it a little. One of the reasons that I didn't really think one of the reasons that I didn't really find the 5DS to be all that attractive for me, even though I do some landscape work and, you know, that kind of resolution would be awesome for a landscape, is the pixel or the file size is so big that I would be very hesitant to use the camera for all kinds of functions and tasks. You know, it would be the 5DS is the camera I take when I'm going to go do landscapes, and if I'm going to take pictures of my family around the holidays or whatever, or I'm going to do some snapshots or whatever, that kind of thing, or, you know, I'm just running out for a non super important sunset or sunrise, or there's a lightning storm or something like that, I'm going to take some other camera because I'm not going to have 50 meg per frame or bigger images. And so we're going from 22 megapixels in the 5D Mark III to 30 megapixels in the 5D Mark IV. It's a 36% increase in resolution, if I did the math there correctly. The file sizes are they're not double, so I'm not going to have my cards like I did with the 1D to the 5D. I think this is kind of reasonable, and there is a trade-off to be made in pixel density in cameras, in digital SLRs, small format digital SLRs. As you scale the resolution up and therefore the pixel size down, the camera becomes diffraction limited at lower and lower apertures. And this is actually in some ways, I think, a problem for like the EOS M series, where this is actually a problem that I see in like the EOS M series. The M3 at 24 megapixels is diffraction limited at just under f6.3. And to keep the size of the lenses down, Canon is setting the max aperture on a number or on some of their lenses, especially the 55 to 200, to f6.3. And so where you had a buffer in the past to stop down a little to improve sharpness, that buffer really isn't there anymore with a high resolution sensor, at least not in the most straightforward and direct approach, which brings me actually to the next kind of point that is, I think, a big plus in the 5D Mark IV. And in some respects, I think it's actually something that Canon should be implementing in like their Rebels and their EOS M's, and just making it a built-in feature of the camera that you can't really turn off. And that's the new lens optimization system, the digital lens optimizer, and the fact that it bakes the changes or can do the changes to raw files. That with the 5D Mark III, I could always bring images into Digital Photo Professional and do the digital lens optimization to the lens, including diffraction correction, which, again, you know, big point. And I had done some tests recently or earlier this year where I had messed around with seeing how good the diffraction optimization diffraction correction in Digital Photo Professional was. And I was quite surprised to find that on my 70-200 f4, I could shoot at f22, do the diffraction correction, and it looked very much like the lens wide open. And that lens isn't tack sharp wide open. It gets sharper as you stop down. I mean, it's not pour wide open. So, you know, that's a pretty reasonable or pretty good statement. And now you can do it in the 5D Mark IV and have it baked into your raw files ready to go so you don't have to mess with it in post. Now, Canon does say that the quality of the diffraction correction in camera is not as good as the quality of diffraction correction in Digital Photo Professional. And beyond that, Canon, I'm not sure what the situation is. If you could take a diffraction corrected in camera image, bring it into Digital Photo Professional and tune it or finish it or get the full quality out of it after the fact. But for people like me, and I suspect a lot of photographers who use software like Adobe's Lightroom, that's a big deal because Lightroom doesn't do diffraction correction at all. And I suspect it will be a long time before Lightroom starts doing diffraction correction or transverse chromatic aberration correction, for that matter, where you have different color fringing based on whether it's in front of or behind the focal plane, the plane of focus. And so being able to take care of this stuff in camera is, I think, a rather nice thing. Like I said, it's certainly a high-end feature in the sense that, you know, we're getting it in a high-end camera. But like where I think diffraction correction really belongs as sort of a default is in cameras like the EOS M or the M3 or the, you know, the Rebels, that kind of thing. Cameras where people consistently are pairing now high resolution sensors with relatively slow, very nearly diffraction limited out of the gate lenses. The other major technology in the sensor or that aspect of the camera is the dual pixel sensor. Originally the technology was basically being used for autofocus with the two subpixels. Canon could derive phase information from the, you know, way the light focused, and then autofocus using a ostensibly contrast-based system, but have directionality information to know which way to drive the lens towards focus, so you didn't get that, like, really annoying characteristic breathe back forth wrong way guess half the time focus thing that like you see in most contrast based or in all contrast based systems that don't have some form of phase and direction information. Now they're actually doing something with it, and this is a first in Canon cameras as far as I'm aware. I'm pretty sure nothing else is doing this kind of thing with dual pixel architecture. They've introduced a new RAW format that stores the dual pixel information, and they are now allowing photographers to make micro adjustments to their image in like bokeh, depth of field, placement of the small adjustments essentially to placement of focus, it seems like, resolution, that sharpness, that kind of thing. Like the first thing I thought of when I thought of seeing this, or the first thing I thought of when I heard about this, what Canon was doing with this is actually like the intelligent implementation of Lytro's light field technology. Lytro, they came to market with a camera. It had a like 40 megapixel sensor that basically, because it was set up to measure light fields and not specific focused pixels, you basically could, you took the image, you could take the file out of it, and in post-processing you could convert that into having focus or depth of field anywhere you wanted. The downside, well, there was a lot of downsides in my opinion, but the big downside from a technical perspective was that you had a 40 megapixel file essentially, or a 40 megasensil file, or however you want to put it. So it ended up being like a 40 megabyte file for a like 10 megapixel image, and a 10 megapixel regular RAW file was only like 10 megabytes or 12 megabytes or something to that effect. And that's a pretty big, you know, level of overhead. I also had qualms with the way Lytro was selling it. They were selling it as, you know, your people who look at your picture can shift the focus around anywhere they want and so on and so forth. And like my first two thoughts were, first of all, most photographers or most non-serious photographers, most people who would, you know, sort of benefit the most, you could say, from this kind of camera, they have a hard time composing a picture with one subject in focus, having to make that where they compose a picture and the viewer can move the focus around to look at other things. Really didn't like that kind of, I didn't see that. And then from my perspective as a serious photographer, focus and depth of field are very critical to the artistic image that I'm creating, that I don't want someone to change where the camera or where the picture is focused, and I don't want somebody to crank the depth of field up or down or do something like that. That's not my intent with that image, and it is, you know, my image. I am the artist that's creating it, and I didn't like the technology simply from the perspective of I didn't really see a point having a file that was like four times the size of any other camera file, that I was going to come home, I was going to lock the focus and depth of field to one specific setting, and then I was going to convert it to a JPEG or a TIFF or whatever, and, you know, that was going to be it. I didn't see where there was a huge amount of benefit to that. Dual pixel RAW, on the other hand, isn't offering, and you can reposition focus anywhere and you can completely change the depth of field or anything like that. As a photographer, you're still shooting the depth of field and the placement of focus that you would, that you creatively wanted for a given image. Then you can go back and touch up the sharpness, or you can touch up the bokeh in the background or the foreground or whatever. I'm still not entirely clear on what the extent of, you know, what the extent of what you can do with it is. But again, this is something when I get the camera, I will have time to play with it. I will have the ability to look into see what it is, and I'll probably be writing or talking about it again. The penalty for this is that you have a file that's slightly bigger or slightly smaller than twice the size of a regular RAW file. So a regular RAW file on the 5D Mark IV is about 36 megabytes based on Canon's estimates, and the dual pixel RAW file is about 66 megabytes. Double the size would be 72 megabytes. So it's not, you're paying a penalty, but, you know, if, for instance, if the sharpness can be tweaked up or boosted up to basically near 5DS quality levels, you know, that's a pretty significant boost for this camera. Basically, it undermines the whole need for a 5DS or 5... Well, I won't say it undermines, but it partially undermines the whole market for the 5DS and the 5DSR. Of course, I would expect in future iterations, those cameras will have dual pixel RAW, and then you'll get like really sharp, you know, really high quality pictures out of it. The thing that I think is interesting that I don't see with the whole dual pixel RAW thing, although it may just be built into like, say, HDR or something like that with this camera, is, so Magic Lantern, if you're not familiar with the Magic Lantern, they're a third-party supplemental open source firmware add-on for most or many of Canon's cameras. Magic Lantern, a while back, created a mode called dual ISO RAW. And basically, it took every two, you know, alternating two line pairs or alternating line pairs out of the sensor. So every line you'd have the full bare block. It would take alternating line pairs and it would read them at alternating ISOs. So like the first line pair could be read at ISO 100 and the second line pair could be read at ISO 800 and then back to 100 and back to 800 and so on and so forth. And it cranked out a DNG file that looked like crap until you did some post-processing on it. And there was a bit of software that they had provided along with it that would, basically the way it works is it would take the highlights from the lowest ISO, it would take the shadows from the higher ISO, or the low ISO, it would take the shadows from the high ISO, and it would combine the low and high ISOs together to make the midtones. And your 12-stop 5D Mark III all of a sudden was producing a 15 or 16 stop dynamic range image because of having the ability to see further into the shadows for instance. And the problem with dual pixel raw in Magic Lantern, if you'd call it a problem, is that because it's done with alternating line pairs, the vertical resolution of the highlights and the shadows would be halved. So you would have the same horizontal resolution, but the vertical resolution would be half of what the camera normally produced. And you could see this in images. I tried it, I played with it, I thought, okay, you know, this is kind of interesting, and kind of did a couple of pictures and went, I think I'll pass. That I wasn't thrilled with the whole vertical halving of resolution and highlights and shadows. It wasn't always noticeable, but it could be noticeable in some images. With Canon's dual pixel technology, presumably they could read the pixels out at independent ISOs and have a similar effect. Only this time, the two pixels are reading basically, or the two subpixels are reading under the same primary micro lens and under the same color filter. And the resolution, basically, you would kind of have the horizontal resolution, but you could fudge it so that it really wasn't, you know, like you kind of ignored that. And the fact that you were looking at basically be having the horizontal resolution on a pixel level as opposed to two lines level or two pixels level. And actually, well, because it was two line pairs, it'd be four pixels basically level. And that much finer resolution potentially would allow you to get better highlights and shadows and extend the dynamic range. And I haven't seen anything in the manual or the documentation that indicates that Canon is doing that in their dual pixel thing. It seems like they're just using it for sharpness. You know, they're not using it for like high dynamic range or something like that, which to me is a little bit unfortunate, because like one of the problems with a multi-shot HDR is things move and then you have to align things. And then if the subject moves, you get ghosting and all kinds of stuff. Where with a one-shot HDR, where you're reading the sensor out at different, you know, or parts of the sensor out at different levels, you are potentially, free of that temporal distortion. Okay, getting to the end. The last thing I really want to talk about, and then I'm going to call this, is the user interface, the ergonomics, and the usability. In past things, like with the 5D Mark III or the 1DX Mark II or the 1DX or whatever, there has been somewhat significant changes in the usability of the camera. And with the 5D Mark IV, that's really not the case. The major changes are actually, or the biggest changes are actually somewhat, you know, minor. I won't say they're trivial, but they're relatively minor. There's now an AF area selection switch next to the multi-controller. The multi-controllers changed texture and shape slightly. I'm not a big deal about that. Canon's changed the order of the iconography on the top of the camera. The functions are still the same, but the icons are reversed, swapped left to right. The, you know, functions are still in the same place, but like where on my 5D Mark III, it would have the ISO icon on the left and the flash exposure compensation on the right over the ISO flash exposure compensation button. On the Mark IV, the flash exposure compensation's on the left and the ISO's on the right. I don't know why they changed that, but, you know, they changed it on the, 7D Mark II, and the 5DS is that way too. They moved the terminal for the cable release to the front of the camera. Personally, I think this is a good thing, largely because I'm a Really Right Stuff L-plate user, and having the terminal on the front of the camera means that it doesn't interfere with the L-plate. The L-plate doesn't have to be designed to kind of scooch around it. It's right there on the front of the camera. Accessibility of that should be pretty good. I don't really see what the big deal is, or, you know, I don't see there being any real big deal. It's just, you know, in a new location. The other external change really is The rubber covers for the ports on the left side of the camera have been sort of redivided. It's now, there's a dedicated, the cable release terminal has been moved, so it's on the front of the camera under its own cover. The PC sync port for manual flash or triggering has its own cover. It's under its own thing. The mic in and headphones out are under their own combined cover. And then the HDMI port and the USB 3 port are under their own combined cover. Canon says that this is going to make it better because there's not going to have exposed ports. To get to one of the functions. Like, you don't have to open all the ports to plug a cable release in on, you know, or open three of the ports to plug a cable release in. Okay, I guess. If they were going for this whole thing, I would have liked to have seen the HDMI and USB 3 ports under separate covers, because then you wouldn't have to expose the USB 3 port when you plug an HDMI monitor in. But again, not a real big deal, not a huge change in usability or whatever. The final sort of point is Canon, well, at least the final point I'm going to be looking at or talking about is Canon is using their latest version of their intelligent viewfinder. And I got to be honest, I like the intelligent viewfinder in theory, but I don't think Canon has found the right practice yet. Autofocus points are good. The viewfinder grid, good. The level, because that's now on its own separate indicator in the viewfinder. I'm going to say good to that. But Canon has a whole slew of icons that they're adding across the bottom in the field of view in the viewfinder. Battery remaining, the shooting exposure or the exposure mode. So you program manual, aperture priority, custom 1, 2, 3, the white balance mode, the drive mode, the AF mode, the metering mode, whether the camera's in JPEG or RAW, whether digital lens optimizer is active, whether dual pixel RAW is active, whether there's flicker going on, the generic warning that actually covers a whole slew of things that you can set that to pop up on, and then the AF status light. Now, I may just be weird in all of this, but my sort of feeling is uncluttered view. Now, admittedly, you can turn off any of the stuff you don't want in the viewfinder, so you don't have to have all of this stuff cluttered around in the bottom of your viewfinder. Admittedly, my perspective on the whole what you have in your viewfinder thing tends to be that the viewfinder is your lens into what you're shooting, and it's or your window into what you're shooting, and it should be as uncluttered and as efficient as possible. It should only show you the information you really need to know when you're shooting. And it should show it to you in a way that's concise and efficient for you to see and understand and, you know, use. And some of these things, obviously the level, the grid, the autofocus points are things that need to be superimposed over the image either because of function or they're necessary for composition or, you know, when you're working in your composition. I'm fine with all that stuff. The metering modes and all of that, I just don't see the need to litter the viewfinder with that, so to speak. And one outstanding question that I'm not sure of, I'll know at some point, you know, like when I get the camera, is whether this stuff lights up. Because if it doesn't light up and you're shooting against a dark subject matter, or you have a dark area at the bottom of your picture, a shadow, or you're shooting at night, you can't see any of it anyway. So having the battery status in there, and if it doesn't light up when you have the focus points lit up or something like that, you won't really be able to know. And I've noticed, like on my 5D Mark III, I have the warning symbol. It's a, you know, black like stop sign with an exclamation point, or a black octagon with an exclamation point. And it's black. And if it comes on, because I have the camera set to spot metering, which is one of the things that it can come on when that happens, or when that's set, I hardly ever notice that it's actually on. That, you know, that that's not something that is really obvious to me when I'm using the camera, because it's dark and it's in a corner. And a lot of times that corner is in shadow. And so that viewfinder is black, in, you know, black icon superimposed over dark background. You know, below that, you have, you know, below the screen, view screen part of the viewfinder, you have like the status bar, and that's all LED yellow backlit, or yellow LED, or yellow OLED, or whatever they're using for it now. And on that respect, all of that stuff jumps out, regardless of, you know, the brightness of what's in the scene. And, you know, that's there's a whole slew of things that Canon's got kind of in there where, again, if you, I don't really know what, where the need for the indication is in the viewfinder. There's a lot of things there that I think if they got rid of it, they could make the text a little bigger, a little easier to read. They could make the exposure meter bar easier to see or bigger than, you know, what they're using. And, you know, I don't, you know, maybe it's just I don't understand how a lot of people would go about using the camera. But, you know, for instance, one of the things that they have in the iconography in the status bar is whether the highlight priority mode is enabled, which I never understood why that has D plus as the icon, because that's, you know, all the D's in highlight priority mode. But that seems to me, and again, maybe I just don't understand people using the camera, like the kind of thing that you know you have on because you leave it on all the time, and it's something you use because, or something you, you know, distinctly, directly, you know, it's a major part of your stuff. It's not something you're switching on and off, on and off, on and off. So, but, you know, it's there. And the same thing goes, there's a little ISO, you know, icon that next to the ISO, which, again, okay, I can see, you know, yeah, it tells you that the numbers are for the ISO, but, like, shouldn't you know that? Because that's where the ISO numbers are. They don't move around. So I don't quite grasp what Canon is, where they're going with the intelligent viewfinder. It doesn't always seem so intelligent to me. And I think with that, you know, I said this was going to be long. I was thinking it was going to be more like an hour. We're now at an hour and a half, and I know I'm not going to edit 30 minutes of content out of this, if any. So, I think I'm going to wrap it up here. Overall, I'm really excited to see the 5D Mark IV. I don't see, like I said, aside from, I guess, the gripes the video people have with video, I don't see where there's a huge obvious misstep, or there's a huge obvious something where, you know, I'm looking at the camera going, oh man, I really wish they'd have done something different. It doesn't have to be revolutionary to me. It just has to be solid. And, you know, maybe that's because I'm sitting on a 4-year-old 5D Mark III going, but it looks like a good camera to me. It looks like a you know, pretty solid deal. Like I said, I'm not going to say it's the most significant camera announced this year because, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. It is the most significant camera announced for me this year because it's my next camera. And, you know, with that, I guess, you know, the 5D Mark IV should start shipping on the September 8th. Who knows what the back order list is going to look like. But, you know, there it is. Until next time.